Welcome to Trapping Across America, where fur brothers meet every week. Where we're still allowed to be men, and we're proud to be from the land of the fur and the home of the brave. Welcome everybody to Trapping Across America. I'm your host, Clint Locklear. We have a little bit different style of show tonight. I'm going to be actually away from home, so I'm pre-recording this way ahead of time because I won't be able to do that. I'm on a control job over North Carolina, and there's going to be two shows back-to-back that are being pre-recorded while I'm gone, and I hope you enjoy them. Tonight's going to be a little bit different than anything I've ever done. The kind of the moral of the story of the show tonight, if I can become a professional trapper, if I can be someone that makes his living from the trapping industry, anybody that's driven can do it. And I'm going to have some proof for you tonight, because I'm going to do something you probably have never heard of or seen someone that sells books and videos and makes lure and stuff do before. I'm going to kind of make fun of myself and show guys that you read about, guys that you see all these pictures of and stuff. It didn't start that way. It's not even close to starting that way. What normally happens, it's the same with everybody. Get excited about trapping. You go out, you buy your equipment, you read and watch everything you can get your hands on. You go out to the field and basically get your ass kicked because the experience and the animal knowledge is not there. But if you keep going and you keep striving and you keep learning, come up with a plan and work that plan, you can do pretty much whatever you want to do in the trapping industry, whether it be fur trapping, control trapping, urban control trapping, anything like that. Now, I know a lot of trappers, when they see us at the Nationals, and we got all the pictures, and you look at our websites, and you see these great big catches of, you know, 8, 9, 10 cats and 20 coyotes and, you know, 8, 9 otter, 30, 40 beaver, all that. You know, when you see that from getting started or from being in it a while and you're working a job, there's a lot of things there that needs to be taken into consideration. The first one is the person that's making these catches, whether it be me or anybody else. No one started off that way. No one started off being a good trapper. No one started off making big catches or really having any clue at all what they're doing for. And when you see guys that just keep continually improving and learning and finding different ways and getting better at things, that's, to me, is the mark of a good trapper. Someone who's a lot better now than they were last year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years ago. That's how you know that the trapper is really cooking with all gas, is he's growing as he's trapping. Because trust me, it didn't start off that way. At least I know it didn't start off that way with me. Now, if you get frustrated in your own trapping, things don't seem to be working the way you want them to, you're not catching the animals that you want to, and you see all these pictures in the magazines and on the internet and on the trapping forums and in the videos and everything like that, just keep in mind, you're at the same level, at whatever level that is, as anybody that you're looking at. Everybody's been at the same exact level in trapping. Some people just keep striving and make the sacrifices needed sometimes to get a bigger catch than most guys really don't want to do. It's not that they can't do it. It's they just don't want to, a lot of times, make the sacrifices with time and family and fuel and expenses and everything and traveling, being away from home to make some of these catches. So don't give up. And like I said, I'm going to make kind of fun of myself. It's going to be more of a story than anything else. And like I said, most guys that are selling product want everybody to believe that they have all the answers. They know what they're doing at all times, and they just know from all these years of experience. They've been trapping 20 years. They've been catching hundreds and thousands of animals for 20 years, and that's just not the case. So let's go ahead and get started with this. Now, as all good stories, it's got to start at the beginning. My family did not start start me trapping. I didn't have a dad or a granddad or an uncle or something that took me out trapping. We hunted and we fished. We grew up raising horses. You know, we lived out in the country. We were used to handling guns and firearms and doing things like that. But no one that I knew was a trapper. The closest thing as being young and dealing with the fur industry is when I was living with my mother down in South Alabama around Phenix City and Columbus, Georgia. We would go out in a little bitty 10-foot John boat with a .22 rifle and a spotlight hooked to a car battery, and we would shoot beaver. Now, this would have been, I'm terrible with dates, but this would have been 81, somewhere around in there. And there are all these ponds right on the side of the road. Think back on it now, I don't even think we had permission on any of them, as bad as that is to say. But, you know, there was easy access, and there was water, and there was beaver in there, so we went shooting. Somebody told me and my stepdad that there was a guy that was buying beaver. So we took some of the beaver over there. Of course, during this time, fur was really high. And when we first started out, was getting about $30 a beaver. And we were just throwing it up on the table. And he would give us this money. And, I mean, that was just awesome. Because you got to think, back then, as most of y'all know, $30 was a whole lot more than it is now as far as what it was worth and what it could get you. Well, we did that for a little while, then me and some friends started going out on the weekends, and I'm talking about pulling all-nighters and maybe going to a little more shooting beaver than we probably should have because of our grades and stuff. But as the fur market seemed like it went up, I didn't know anything about the fur market. All I know is there's this old guy over in Columbus, Georgia. I throw this beaver up on the table, and pretty much towards the end, when I was still living down there, we were getting $40 a beaver. Well, you get two beaver, that's as much as you'd make at that time, working a full-time job, being my age, you know, working McDonald's or somewhere. So, I mean, it was awesome money. And it didn't matter. We're shooting them with 22s. A lot of them had three or four holes in them. And when they sunk, because we didn't know to shoot them at the end of the nose, we were just aiming at the head. Only way we could get the beaver up is we built us this frog gig, this two-pronged frog gig thing with these spikes coming backwards, and we would stab that at the bottom of the lake till we felt the beaver. We would puncture the beaver to get it back on board. The fur buyer never said anything to us, so he knew after the first couple ones, but the money was so good. I mean, it was so motivating. So, one of the first times that I dealt with fur, it had a monetary value to me. You know, losing sleep to gain the money made more sense. And I can tell you, at high school at that time, I probably had more money, spending money, than the teachers did because of the beaver were bringing such good money. And I don't remember anybody ever talking about trapping, even though the fur boom was on, which is hard to imagine when you hear the stories now and there was a trapper and a trap behind every bush. There just didn't seem to be that. Guys are just really quiet about it. But that's how I kind of got started in the fur. Now, I didn't really get started in trapping until I was in the military, and I stationed up at Fort Wainwright, Alaska. And I was in division headquarters for a little while, and I was in my office was considered G3 training. And what I did in that job was I was the guy that set up all the coordination and took all the applications for the schools of division, and then I would get the guys to school. Well, G3 Air, they handle, just like it says, they handle all of the helicopters and flights and stuff like that. They coordinated all that throughout the division. And there was an interesting guy that was really down to earth, which was pretty strange for an officer. And his name was Captain Murphy. And we kind of hit it off, but, you know, being enlisted and him being an officer, it wasn't like we were buddy buddies or anything, but he kept talking about trapping. And I didn't know anything about it, but it really piqued my interest. And he was talking about catching lynx and fox and different stuff like that. And I think he actually, because I showed some interest, he showed me a couple of trapping magazines. And, you know, when you went to the grocery store in Fort Wainwright, Alaska, I could buy mink and marten stretchers at the grocery store. Just think about that, guys. You know, when you went to the video store, like a Blockbuster, which they didn't have anything like that, it was 80% hunting, fishing, and trapping videos, and you had this small section of videos. Totally different world than we live in down here in the lower 48. I could go to Kmart last year I was up there and buy 375 H&H Magnum off the shelf. I mean, it was an awesome place to get started. Fur was everywhere. In all the stores, they sold stuff. There was a tannery there in Fairbanks. Dean Wilson, the designer of the Manning No. 9, he actually bought fur out of Fairbanks, Alaska. And I got to go into a shop in there. So once I kind of started investigating it, you know, it's all of a sudden trapping was everywhere around me. And at that time, being an E-4 in the military, we made about $1,400 a month. That was it. Alaska is not a cheap place to be. So $1,400 a month was all that I could make playing Army. But if I went out and caught a Martin, which I had no idea what it was except off of a video, that was $50. Fox, when I was in Alaska, were bringing about 40 to 50. When I came back home, they were bringing about 8. But the quality, if you ever see one of those foxes up here, you'll know exactly why they're worth so much money. And there's lynx and beaver everywhere. I'd be out pike fishing, see 15, 20 beaver in a day fishing, just swimming around, because there is no nighttime up there in the summer. Muskrats everywhere. You'd see fox running around post. We would jump them all the time, grouse hunting, stuff like that. So the fur was there. I started getting an interest there. And because of the pay in the military, the money had a strong effect. So between me shooting beaver when I was little and getting $40 a piece to the fur in Alaska, pretty much it started every time that I set a trap, there was a monetary value to it. And that has a lot to do with the reason I look at trapping so much as a profession or a way to make income now. That's just the way it is. It never was really just a heritage or a sport thing. It was almost out of necessity. And so, you know, when I write about a professional trapper and think of it like a business and things like that, that's because that's what it's always been to me. Now, what really, besides Dennis talking about it, getting me interested about it, because he was excited about it, I was excited about it. I didn't know what the hell I was doing with it, but I wanted to do something with it. Well, down at the video store, I picked up a video. It's called Wilderness Trapping by Mike Lipinski, which you can still order. I've seen it advertised in a few places, and if you're somewhere in the snow, it's a great video. It's shot in Montana, and so I got this video and I rented it, and I probably kept that thing for about a week, even though the charges were adding up. I watched that thing every night. I watched how he made the sets and kind of where he was putting them and all this other stuff. And I was getting so fired up about it. Well, I went down to our local PX on base, and because they were crazy enough, or I was stupid enough, one or the other, they gave us like a base credit card. So I'm down there buying 110s and number 2 long springs and all these different type traps, because I'm going to go trapping, you know. And I think Dennis told me about a Fur Fishing Game magazine, and he may have let me borrow his copy of the Alaskan Trapper's Handbook. I ended up buying one later at the PX on base. And I still didn't know at that time that there was a trapping association per se, or I'd have been going to that. And I wish I would have, because it had definitely helped on my learning curve. Well, I get the video. I'm getting the traps. I start going to yard sales up there on a weekend. I'd find some yard sale somewhere that they'd have traps of some kind. I was buying number 4 jumps. I bought a bunch of snares, which will come into the story later. Didn't know anything about snaring except the drawings that were in the Alaskan handbook. What I didn't know that these were 1/8 inch 1x19 or stainless Thompson wolf snares. Well, I'm thinking fox and Martin and beaver, and if you've been snaring, you can kind of see where that story is going to go downhill in a heartbeat. Well, season finally came around. I'm all fired up opening day. I don't know why they wait in Alaska for trapping season to start so late, because there's already 4.5 feet of snow on the ground by the time day opens. I don't know anything about anything. Only thing I know is what I've seen in the videos. I got some Tom Miranda videos, which I'll explain. That did not apply to Alaska in any stretch of the imagination. So I go out and I get a map and I just find pretty much a loop, because I read that in some magazine. You don't want to have downtime. Now, I couldn't afford a snow machine, but I was in good shape because of the military. I had Army-issued snowshoes and a backpack, which is what we trained and played Army with anyway. So that's what I load up. And I'm telling you, the first day I went out there, I had my full rucksack so loaded down with number two, number one long springs, and 110 Conibears, nails, a hatchet, pruning shears. And my trap line was based off, if I could pull off of the road, because there was so much snow built up on the side of the road, if I could pull off somewhere, that was starting point of the trap line. I'd get out and I would just take off, basically. And my loops would be somewhere between the 4 to 6 mile range on the snowshoes carrying that pack. I didn't know anything about, I just knew Martin were in the hemlock trees or spruce trees. So when I found a bunch of those, that's where I put traps. I was probably putting out one Martin trap per 100 yards to 200 yards over a 5 mile loop. And when I'd get back to the truck, I'd drive up the road somewhere else, and then I would run another loop that would be about the same distance. And I could only run about two of those loops at a time, because that's 10 miles on snowshoes on the weekends. There's no trap check law in Alaska, at least there wasn't at that time. And nothing was alive, hardly ever, because when the cold metal and it's 25 below zero, you didn't have to worry about anything, you know, being alive. When that steel hit them, it pretty much just did the coup de grace on them, and they would be dead. But I do remember the first trap that I ever set in my life. I'm going to the first tree that I don't remember how I was marking. I was probably marking some of the trees or falling snowshoe or something. When I come to this tree that I knew the trap was on, and the top sets I were making, where you put two nails in the side of one of the trees and you cut these branches off and you kind of make this upside down cubby of just branches. And then I was using these little brackets that I got probably from Dean Wilson or from the PX, and I would nail those in the tree and put the 110 on there. Now you can buy them from Minnesota and places like that, and you just nail that to the tree. Only way the Martin could get to the lure, which Dean Wilson showed me how to make, which was skunk and Vaseline, and then I would have a bunch of salmon heads from salmon fishing in the summer. That was my bait, the salmon, the lure was the skunk. I'd build this cubby, and that's all I knew how to do besides some leaning poles. So I'd just go off through the wilderness, basically, which was kind of foolish thinking of it now, and I'd set these loops. The first trap I had, I come to the tree, something didn't look right. I couldn't find my cubby. I knew I was at the right place. So the first trap I set held a big male Martin. And let me tell you, and he was alive, because I didn't know at that time to use 120s, and I was just using the 110. But he probably hadn't been caught very long. It was about 10 below zero. I remember that day pretty well. It was a beautiful day. A lot of snow, deep snow. I was probably sweating like a pig. But I remember it was really cold, icicles hanging off of me, bluebird sky, and there sat that Martin in that trap. And, you know, at that time, that's the first time it ever entered my mind, well, how do you dispatch anything? Well, me and the hatchet, we went to work using the blunt side. I finally got the thing dead, and I was just absolutely amazed holding that Martin for the first time. I mean, it was huge compared to what I thought it would be. And, you know, running your hands through the fur and smelling the weasel and the whole 9 yards. And I think that day ended up with a first check with two Martin out of all those traps, walking 10 miles on snowshoes. And I was the happiest camper in the world that you've ever met. I mean, I was on my way to being a professional trapper from that moment on in my mind. Now, keep in mind, my whole 30-day income was $1,400. I just made $100 on a Saturday. So that was a pretty big deal to me at that time. And the first year, I pretty much stuck with just marten trapping. And one of the funny things I remember is I was setting some, I think it was a number one or an aught that I bought at a pawn shop. And I was using the leaning pole. And if you've never seen that, it's just you just find a natural leaning tree on a 45 degree angle, or you cut one, or you pull one off the bottom of the forest and you wire it up to a tree. So you got this 45, and then you put your foothold on there with some light wire. And then you wire the trap off to the pole, and above that you put your bait and lure and put some spruce over it so the blue jays and stuff don't rob you blind. So I remember this one time I'm coming up on this trap, and again, something didn't look right. I knew I had something. The wire was gone. I'm starting to look around. Someone stole my trap, man. I knew something was there, and it was gone. I couldn't believe it. And then as I'm looking around, after about 3 or 4 minutes, I'm frustrated. I'm getting kind of upset. You know, now I've got an animal running around with a trap on its foot. And I look down, and there's a yellow spot in the snow where something was peed. Well, I kind of kick at it, and when I do, the snow blew up. This poor marten, after getting caught in a trap, somehow works the wire off the top of my leaning pole, gets on the snow, figures he's free, takes a leak. It's so cold it freezes on the chain, and the marten don't have enough butt to move the chain. So what held the marten was the drag of urine that froze around the chain. I didn't care, but you know, that was one of the memories of marten trapping, besides a lot of cold and a lot of miles. I had a good time, didn't have a clue what I was doing. I think that first year I caught like 12 or 14 marten. And I was excited. Then over the summer, I kept buying more equipment when I had the money. And then I was going to branch out, and I was going to beaver trap, and I was going to fox trap. Because everywhere that I would go, there's fox sign up there. I'd cross them 3 or 4 different times on these 5-mile loops. Fox bringing good money. Beavers, a lot of water around Fairbanks if you've never been up there. A lot of ponds, a lot of creeks. The Chena River went right through the post. So I went out and I marked all these beaver runs all summer long. I used flagging. I mean, I spent hours going around these things. Now, here's the difference between someone that's from the south, goes up to Alaska and starts marking something in the summer, not thinking about the winter. When you get 4 foot of snow, your markings, when it starts blowing, are no longer there. So when I go back all excited to snare these beaver under the ice, I couldn't find a den nowhere. Total waste of time. God, I mean, it just drove me insane. Well, I get up there and I find these lodges, and I'm going off the videos and going off the books and the information. I've got my snares I've been holding on to for about a year, and I start chipping this ice away. Well, that's the first time I realized chipping ice, what I've seen it in these videos, where it's 6 inches thick, and chipping ice in Alaska, where it's 2.5 to 4 foot thick, a little bit different ball game. So I decide, well, this is a waste of my time. So I go back and I get an ice auger. So I go out there and I auger down through the first set I made. I remember it had to have been close to 4 foot of ice on this pond. I auger down through there and I hit water, and I sit there with this chisel, and I beat and I beat and I beat. Well, about 4 hours into this trap line, I'm exhausted, and I finally get to put my first snare in front of this pole. Well, I put my wolf snare. You know, now we know to use 1/16. I'm using 1/8. I go up, I chop all this wood down, I get my bait on there, and I'm wiring it up, and I've got all these snares on these going in all different directions, and I'm all excited, so I go over. And I go to a different pond to find another house. I chip through about 3 foot of ice on that. Now it's all day long. I got 2 whopping beaver sets out. I'm exhausted. It's 20, 30 below zero. I'm soaking wet. I go to work that week, and I come back the next week, and I go to check these beaver sets. This is where inexperience will get you in trouble. And I can tell you, this is not an exaggeration. When I went down through the ice to to get that beaver again. I didn't know how to pack it to insulate it. So now I've got to chip down through another 3.5-4 foot of ice to get to even check the snares. First snare was nothing. Now I'm a couple hours into finding an empty snare. Let me tell you, the exhilaration starts going down pretty quick. So I'll go over to my second one. I'm beating and I'm chiseling and I'm augering, and I finally get down to where I find it. Luckily, I did find the snare, and lo and behold, in that wolf snare, or in one of those wolf snares, if I remember right, I had 8 snares on this one pole, there was a beaver in the snare. What the beaver did is it floated up to the bottom of the ice and froze away from my hole. So now I'm chipping these other holes around. I'm like an ice gopher out there trying to get close enough to this beaver. By the time all said and done, I finally get my beaver above ice. And by the time I break it loose, I've got an extremely beautiful beaver on one side and a hatter beaver on the other, because his hair still stuck to the ice underneath that, where it floated up to the top. And that was about, I swore off beaver trapping at that moment. This was, you know, I spent a whole day, I get 2 sets in, and by the time I do catch one, because I wasn't smart enough to shorten the snares, I've got pretty much a worthless beaver. So that's the end of that. So I'll go back to marten trapping. Go back doing my 10-12 loops, 12-mile loops on the snowshoes. I'm catching some marten. I'm seeing these fox tracks. Now, in the Alaskan Handbook of Trapping, I'm reading this and I'm studying this, and they're making these cubbies, and then I've seen Tom Miranda on his winter ice thing where he's making these dirt holes or kind of a flat set with an ice and a broom. So the first fox set I made, I mean, with all everybody that starts trapping goes through this in one form or another. I watched that video about 4 times. I made sure I knew exactly what Tom Miranda was doing on that thing. And I head out to the Alaska wilderness where I know there's fox at, because I've seen them. I've even called some there. Shot a few fox. With my broom, my number 2 long spring, because that's what I had. And then I had my axe, my lure that I bought, and then the skunk stuff I was making with the Vaseline. And I start brooming. Now, the difference between Tom's video and Fairbanks, Alaska, is Tom's in 6 inches of snow, and there again, I'm back at 4 foot of snow. So after about 2.5 feet of shoveling or brooming this snow out of the way, I finally get frustrated to go to the truck. I get my snow shovel out of the back of the truck, and I start digging down, because Tom went down to bare ground, so therefore Clint's got to go down to bare ground. And I dig out this hole, it's 4 foot deep. Now, the snow that I'm throwing out is building up top. So I'm in an 8-foot hole to finally get down to the frozen ground. And I'm looking up at this thing, and I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get out of here, but I've already got my stuff with me. So I make this set. I chop out my trap bed. I chop out my little flat set thing. I put my stick with my lure on it, just like Tom did. If you've never been in really, really deep snow, you got to almost swim out of it. So I'm crawling up the side of this. I take the broom just like Tom did, and I make that little trail going back to the main road where I'm going to get back off on it. And I just know when I come back out there in a few days, I've got Mr. Red waiting on me. What happened? I come back out there, and my hole from the wind is completely snowed over. So now I got to go get the shovel out of the truck again. I'm going back out there and I dig this hole again to find the traps frozen solid in the ground, because calcium chloride not really made for 40 or 20 to 30 below zero, or at least not the way I did it. And that sun gun froze shut. So now I'm going to go back, and I'm totally frustrated. I pull the trap. So I start making cubbies, and I make cubbies everywhere, because some of these old roads, they do grade up through some good fox country around Fort Wainwright. This was actually on post. You could go at that time, and I'm sure you still can, and you would register this trap line, which probably wasn't but, I don't know, 100 acres or something, or 1,000 acres or something. It wasn't that big. But, you know, that was your trap line, and they would grade the roads for the training going on, and you'd go in there and you'd trap and catch whatever's there. So I'm determined to catch these fox. There's fox tracks running everywhere. I mean, and the fox in Alaska are huge and just beautiful. I mean, their hair on the side of their neck goes out past their ears. It's something to behold if you've never seen an Alaskan red fox in the wintertime. I make cubbies everywhere. I bet I've got out 30. I don't catch a freaking thing. This goes on for about 3 weeks. I'm so determined to catch a fox that I actually pulled my Martin traps because I knew after looking at these drawings in these old books, that's all you've got to do. I make them. I tried making dirt holes in the snow. Everything they said to do, to do. I'm hanging. I'm also hanging these wolf snares on these fox trails. Now, they're painted black because they were dyed black. That's the way I bought them. And they stood out like a sore thumb, and the loop size I'm making on that stainless steel cable, it'd take four fox at one time to hit that snare to close it, but I didn't know that. And the way that Thompson does that lock on those big cables, if you run the loop down to a fox size loop, it's not going to close anyway unless you put a lot of force on it, so that was just a waste of energy. I mean, I was trying everything that I could, which I know most trappers go through on a regular basis. Especially when you're getting started. You read something, you see something, you hear something, you think that's it, you run out and you put all this energy into it, and then reality sets in and it didn't work out the way you planned. And I'm going to tell everybody that's listening to this my secret in the snow fox set. Because once I figured this out, I'm telling you, this is a fox killing system. It's not something that someone that makes videos like me is probably ever going to put on a video if I get back up north, for the simple fact it is childlike as you can get. How I caught my first fox, actually my first fox catch was a triple. And I got so mad at doing traditional sets in the snow that weren't really made for 4.5 of powder snow. Then I started going, I know that they got to eat and they're going to want food because they're hungry. I know they're going on these trails. So I'm going to give them food and I'm going to set those trails in and I'm going to catch these fox. And by God, it worked. But it's as childlike as you can get. My secret fox set for anybody that's living up north. Just don't tell anybody that you got this from Clint if anybody sees you doing this. I would go and I would go to the cheaper grocery store in town, which is not cheap compared to everywhere else, and I would buy these 25-pound bags of dog food. I'd buy about four of them out of whack. So I'm going out through the Alaskan brush with 100 pounds of dog food and a whole back seat full of these number two dyed on my kitchen stove and hemlock branches, these traps. What I did when I went up there is I just blind setted in these trails in the really thick brush where there's fox tracks just coming and going, which I probably could have caught these foxes blind setting, period. But I put probably 5, 6, 8, some of those trails had to have 10 or 12 traps on them and 20 or 30 feet. And then I'd get off to the side after I kicked the dry snow back on top of it, and I'd take that 25 pounds of dog food and I would start on that one trail and I would back myself up, not stepping on the traps, and I would just pour dog food on top of the snow all the way down that trail with my traps under there. Like I said, the first time I ever caught a red fox, it was a triple, and I thought I had it made. This was getting towards the end of the season. And I ended up, I don't know, catching probably 30 or 40 fox that way. But it was based off of dog food and blind sets. That's how I did it, you know. And I never tried it once I got back down to lower 48. But, you know, heck, if I couldn't catch them any other way, you better believe I'm going down to the co-op and I'm going to buy some dog food and I'm going to give that a shot. Now, one of the things, the memories I have, is selling my fur for the first time, which, You know, the first time I went to an auction in Lower 48, I learned more about fur than I wanted to because I didn't do a very good job of putting it up, and it really hurt my feelings. But when I was in Alaska, I knew that Dean Wilson was somebody because everybody always mentioned him. And he bought fur in an old motel right off the main drag, probably not even a half a mile from the main gate at Fort Wainwright. He just rented out about four rooms. Surely he had to rent them out all year because it smelled like urine and skunk and fur when you went in there. But you go in this motel room, and he's got his little table set up, and there's just piles of wolves and wolverines and lynx and fox and marten and all this stuff around you, and he's got all this tan fur there. Got this little closet in the back, or a bathroom probably is what it was, where he had all his lure and stuff like that. And the first time I went in there, I mean, I was so proud. This was the first year I had probably six or eight marten. And my stretchers I bought at the grocery store, and they were the wire mink stretchers. And on the package, it says mink or marten stretchers. Now, these stretchers are about 8 inches wide, 6 inches wide, and only about 24 inches long. I took my best time putting those marten up. I put them on there. I turned them just the way you're supposed to and everything. And, I mean, it was superb. I was proud as proud could be. Well, I go into his place, and there's an Inuit in there selling a bunch of stuff. So I'm just walking around and looking, and he looks over at me. And, you know, if you've never met me, I'm not the smallest guy in the room normally. You know, I'm about 6'2", about 290, 300 pounds normally. So, you know, it takes a big guy for me to look up to. Well, I had to look up to Dean. He's a big man. And, he asked me what I had, and I said I had some marten. And I'm proud as a peacock, and I throw them things up on his table. And he looks at those marten, and he looks at me. He looks back at those marten, and he looks back at me, and he goes, "What is this?" And I'm sure y'all remember doing something you weren't supposed to do in grade school, and you know you was at the principal's office or heading that direction. You start getting that funny feeling in your stomach. I start panicking in my mind thinking, what in the world have I caught? These must not be marten. I know they weren't squirrels, but I didn't. You know, I'm thinking, well, maybe these really aren't marten. And I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and I can tell he's actually perturbed. He is pretty upset, to be honest with you. I mean, he kept his cool, and he's looking at me, and he keeps going, "What is this?" And I go, "They're marten." And he says, "Reach under the table right there and hand me one of those pelts." And I reach under the table, and I pull out this pelt, and it's every bit of close to, it's got to be as long as a yardstick, and it's about as wide as a yardstick. And I'm holding this thing in my hand. He goes, "Now that's a marten." An instant panic ran through my body because I'm holding this 3-foot thing that he says is a marten, and he's a fur buyer, so he knows what they are. And I'm looking at mine, and mine's only about 14 inches long and 6 inches wide, and I know I've screwed up somewhere. Keep in mind, this is the first year I was trapping. And he said, "How long you been trapping, son?" And I'm looking at him, and I've got that bad feeling. And I said, "About 4 weeks." He goes, "No, how long have you been trapping?" I said, "About 4 weeks." "No, not this season. How long have you been trapping altogether?" And I said, "About 4 weeks, because that's all I've been trapping was about 4 weeks. He said, "You caught these marten?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "How did you catch him?" I told him what I was doing. And he kind of softened a little bit. And he's looking down at me, and he goes, "You put these on wire stretchers, didn't you?" I said, "Yes, sir. I got them at the, I remember right, it was the Safeway." And I told him where I got them. I followed directions on the package. He just shook his hand. And he put his hand on my shoulder. I'll never forget this. And I'm feeling nervous because I'm looking down 6 or 8 marten, $50 a pop. That's like half of my monthly income right there. And I'm looking at it going, this is not going to end well. And he says, "Now I'm going to give you $50 because that's what marten's bringing right now." He said, "But I'm going to have to wet these and restretch them." He said, "Now when I give you the $50 a piece, you're going to buy a dozen of those stretchers over there. And if you ever put a Martin on one of these wire stretchers, don't bring it in here again. Do you understand me, son? All I could think was, yes, sir. And when he put those $50 bills on the table, I was so grateful. And I probably snatched those things off of there because I thought 5 minutes ago I wasn't getting anything. And I bought the stretchers from him. He gave me some belly boards. And I sold Martin off and on to him for the rest of that winter. And, I mean, Dean Wilson's a super guy. And, you know, one thing I remember is he was showing me how to make my own Martin lure before I ever really got started. And he said, you know, he gave me skunk tincture. I said, it's mixed up with Vaseline. So I go out in the parking lot at home. I've got all my Army stuff on because it's 25 below zero, and I heat up some Vaseline, probably in the microwave, and I dump this ounce of skunk tincture in the middle of the parking lot of the Army barracks we're living in. I didn't know that skunk would hold on to anything for that long. So the next day, I go to play Army, and I smell and I reek. Because my Gore-Tex and all that I had on just smelled like skunk. And skunk is not something you smell in Alaska. It did not go over good when we did our formation the next morning. Well, then later I'm looking at the skunk tincture and I see pure skunk quill. I didn't know what that was. He said, well, that's straight. So I'm thinking, well, if cut's good, straight's better. So I buy an ounce of that and then... This was probably about 4 weeks later, and then I had to go, if I remember right, they stuck me on CQ for punishment for the next day because I came in there smelling like skunk again. But I really didn't care, to be honest with you, because I was trapping, and that's all that mattered to me is I was catching fur. And the Army training we were doing during the week, during the winter when I was up there, it was a blur to me because I was like a kid waiting on summer school to get over with or something. So I could go out and play, and all I could think about was what was sitting in those traps I went out there on the weekend. Now, the reason I'm saying all this, because it's the truth. I mean, that's just the way it was. When I started trapping, I did catch fur because I was so determined to catch fur. I also didn't have a clue what I was doing when I went out there and I was trying to catch that fur, but I didn't give up. I just kept setting, and part of the reason I did catch fur, I believe, is because I just set way too many traps, because once I got to know some other trappers, they were kind of horrified that I was setting traps that thick. Now, if they set traps that thick, they'd probably wipe out a local Martin population. I was such a bad trapper, I wasn't hurting the Martin population. I was just doing good to catch two or three or four off one of those 10-mile loops, and then I'd probably move that in a couple of weekends and go somewhere else. One of the other things that happened to me in Alaska that reason a southern boy getting in trouble when you go up north is I was watching, it might have been that wilderness trapping video. Anyway, guys were setting Wolverine sets and I ended up buying like 6 330 conibears. And I cut the buckets with these little corner lips on there the way the video showed. And I had a bunch of salmon and stuff in the back and skunk. And as I'm going out to my Martin sets, there's some really thick, gnarly stuff on some of these lakes and rivers that I could get to from the road. And I'd go down there and I would put these 330 bucket sets out for Wolverine. Because that's what the video, you put it out, the Wolverine find it. They try to go in the bucket, the conibear kills them. Wolverine, those bringing about $300. I was seeing dollar signs. And then I go up there the next weekend. And I cannot find a single bucket or 330 anywhere. I thought for sure someone had robbed me. And that, the buying those 330s on the income I was making that time, it was a hard lick to take. What I found out later, when the snow gets so deep up there, being from the south, I would have never known this, it causes overflow. The snow pushes the ice down, the water comes up and refreezes. For one, knowing what I know now, I was at a terrible location. But I went out there full determined to catch Wolverine. And Mother Nature just showed me that I didn't know what I was doing one more time. But if I went back up there again, I do believe I that's one of the things I've thought of since I've learned so much more about trapping and about animals and different ways to take stuff. What could I do if I went up there now? And one of the reasons I've never went back to Alaska is because I'm afraid I won't come back. And Cindy's mom has got MS, my wife, and when we left, it was because she was pretty sick and Cindy wanted to spend time with her. And that's the reason we came back to the lower 48 to begin with. And Cindy's mom's still going and we're still here and with the business and everything. I don't know if I'd have to probably get that three-letter word, a job, if I went back up there. And I'm kind of spoiled just being trapping now. So part of the thing, I hadn't been up there because I'm afraid to. Because I do believe from the modern technology we have now and the modern traps and me knowing a little bit more about it, I could be a lot better. But at that time, it was so hit and miss. I mean, I was trying to snare fox on the marshes with those wolf snares. Never, ever, ever snared a fox. And I bet I had out 50 or 60 of them buggers all winter long. It was just nothing but frustration. But, you know, one thing, even though the thing that I love about trapping, the part of that, when you learn something, it's yours forever. And when you're out setting traps and you see that sign and you come across those good work fox trails or whatever it is and the snow and you get this idea and you just know it's going to work, the excitement and the buildup of going back to checking it, even if you have a train wreck from it, nothing happens, you get disappointed, you get, you know, thinking everything's going to go wrong. That excitement, that I've got it now. This is going to be the ticket. I know what to do now. And as soon as you find out that you didn't know, well, you kind of tweak it a little bit, and then that excitement's there again. And I don't know of anything else in life that's like that. I mean, there's nothing like that. I mean, you can't compare that with sitting in a tree stand or going out with a fishing pole or anything. There's just something about trapping, I think, that with some people, it just clicks with them, and they're hooked for life. And I'm that way now. But that's how I got started trapping. And it was a disaster compared to, you know, what I'm used to doing now. Because it's experience. It's day after day after day, month after month, year after year of doing it now. Your brain seems to be like a computer, and it just keeps registering stuff. And then before long, you can go out and you can take fur pretty much anywhere under most circumstances. And if you don't know what you're doing when you first get there, you can pull off that memory bank and that computer sitting between your ears, and you can figure something out. And to me, that's just awesome. But the reason I wanted to tell everybody that, and hopefully I didn't bore you to death with it, but that's how Clint Locklear got started in trapping. Got started in Alaska because he needed money. And he went out and he just did it. And it was, by modern standards, really, really poor. Because I bet my catch percentage on traps probably wasn't even 3%. On the weeks, and there was some weekends I didn't catch a freaking thing, but I still enjoyed it, and I still couldn't wait to go out and check the empty traps again, because it was waiting on that animal to, you know, trip or something and get in a trap. I don't know what was going to happen, because looking back on it now, they were so crude and so haphazard. I'm amazed that I caught anything. So if you're in a situation now, you're just getting started trapping, you've been trapping a while, and you're seeing guys that are writing in the magazines, and they're doing the videos and the internet, and they're doing all this, and you see that, you're in the same place they were. And no matter, I mean, talk to Ron Leggett about, it took him, if I remember right, 2 years to catch his first fox. That's just the way it is. But once he got that first fox down, the game was on then. Once he got past all the myths and figured out that they weren't some mythical, you know, super smart animal out there, he started catching them. And the same thing with coon. You know, when you hear these guys catching 1,000 coon, 20, 30 years ago, they might have been catching 100 coon and thought they were doing good. Everybody's at the same place. Everybody can get to the same place. The opportunity's here for everybody to do whatever it is they want to do in trapping. And don't let anybody convince you otherwise. If you want to be a full-time fur trapper, well, then by God, come up with your plan and go do it. If you're wanting to do full-time ADC work, get the education and go about that. Now, if you're wondering, well, how did Clint get from balding beavers and using dog food to catch fox to making a living now for over a decade with just, you know, through the trapping industry? One thing, it came very clear to me when I got back, I needed to get some education. I read everything I get my hands on, which gave information overload. I watched every video I could get my hands on, and most of them said the complete opposite. You know, one of the best videos that I remember ever watching that really got me going as far as a beaver was Charles Dobbins and Wayne Fiebersizer's beaver video. You know, I started watching all of Old Gorman's videos, expensive as they were, and for the education I was getting, that was the cheapest. At that time, I think they were $45 a piece or something like that. Now they're, I think, $63 or something. But as high as that seemed, that cut off years for me. And then I took instruction from Ron Leggett and his dad out there in Maryland. I went out to Montana, which I've been out there twice now, to Craig O'Gorman's. When I went out to Red's, the coon trap, I had him run me around and give me kind of like a down and dirty instruction thing on dry land coon and what to look for and instruction on that. I went to the Trappers College up in Indiana with the fur takers. Some of the local guys around here that I found out when I got back that there was such thing as other trappers and trapping associations, I went with the older guys and I listened. I soaked up every single thing they said, and then I just kept going and questioning and trying to think outside of the box and learning more about animals and doing different things like that. One of the greatest resources trappers have that very few ever really talk about, National Geographic, Discovery Channel. You know, I'd go to the library and I'd get these videos on beaver. They're building their ponds, their documentaries. I would sit there and stop, because at that time there were VHSs, and rewind and stop, and where's their feet going? How are they swimming? You know, everything about it. All the stuff on coyotes, when they came on bobcats, all this stuff I was watching, recording, going over it like that, taking instructions, talking to other trappers, reading books, watching the videos, going and watching demos. When I used to go to conventions, I can tell you right now, I wasn't walking around supply tables. I could care less about that. My butt was planted at the demo area, and I was taking notes because it's something I wanted to do. And over time and through experience with all the book knowledge and the experience of the real world getting involved with that, stuff started to click. And that's what allowed me, because of persistence, to keep going the way that, you know, it allowed me to make a living from fur. And I'm very proud of that fact. And I'm still today trying to figure out a better way, a quicker way, a faster way, a more efficient way to cover more ground, to get out more traps, to look at things a different way. One of the things that I'm doing right now is, like I said last week, working on a cage trap to catch a whole family group of coon at one time. You know, one of the things I'm kind of interested in is I'm getting kind of thinking about some of the cage trapping aspects and how to do that. Anthony Wolfsong has sent me a trap down here that at the right time of my life, I saw the value in it, and we're looking at maybe getting those produced, because it's a very neat muskrat and mink trap that would help me a lot on the rivers down here that I've never seen anything like it. Always trying to come up with a way to do something a little bit better, and that's going to be the key if you're wanting to become a full-time trapper. You can work hard, you can put in the hours, but if you're not learning all the time, to me, you're not really getting the full picture of what's going on around you. And if you want to go to whatever it is level that you want to go, whether that be just 3 weekends out of the year or going full time, always, guys, just try to keep pushing and getting better and doing different things like that. Because I can tell you, by the time I left Alaska, I was a lot better on Martin locations than when I started. I could get away with about half the traps to catch twice as many Martin as when I first started, because it was just pretty much blind luck, and a Martin, it happened to go somewhere too close to a trap and finding it. Towards the end, it got to where location started meaning something to me. You know, I spent a lot of time tracking fox, and when I'd find Martin tracks, I'd sit there and walk before season started and try to figure out what they were doing. And that's about as bad as a bobcat. Those little suckers go everywhere. But it was a learning experience the whole way. And that's that, to me, that's the key, is always thinking about the learning part. Because I can tell you, if the learning stopped in trapping, I'd probably get bored really quick and figure out something else to do. Because a better way is what really gets me ticking. And I hope you're the same way you should be. Because I can tell you, if you're trapping the same way you were 3 years ago, you're not growing. If you're trapping the exact same way you were last year, you're not growing. Even if your catch is good, it can always be better. It can always be a little bit faster. It can always be a little more efficient. Because as you get older, I promise you, you're going to start getting tired a little quicker. And I didn't believe this 10 years ago. I'm starting to believe a little bit now. Get wore out a little bit quicker. You start finding different ways to save a little bit of energy and to catch some different animals that way. So whatever it is that you want to do, guys, just go for it. Because I promise you, every single person has been at the same stage in their trapping career as they progress. So don't get intimidated by somebody with a bunch of pictures of really big catchers or putting videos out, or you're thinking that they've got some type of magical gift or something like that. It's not the case. Everybody starts off as a 100% amateur, and they progress from there. And there's no reason to stay that way, because especially today with all the information we have, I mean, you can go out, anybody can go out with no information, with no experience right now, and go catch animals. The difference is to go out and be a really good trapper, to be an animal trapper instead of a set trapper, takes using your noggin. We all have that. Well, I hope that you found some of this entertaining, and I hope if you're struggling or you're getting frustrated with your trapping, that you think about this as you go out this week. Think outside that box a little bit. Think of how to be a little bit better. Don't get discouraged if you have a bad day or a bad week. Everybody has it. I've had days in Texas where I didn't catch a single animal. I've had days on the river where you go out and you spend 8 hours and you come back with 3 coons and a muskrat, and I'm supposedly a professional trapper. Everybody has those days. I've had trips out of state where it's been an absolute wash. You just don't see those on videos. I mean, what am I going to take a picture of to show at a booth on that? Me almost crying in a corner somewhere? No, that's not the stuff you see. But that's the real life of being a trapper. Is sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and hopefully you always find a way to put odds in your favor. You never fight fair, and you do whatever you need to do to get the job done. That's what makes a good trapper, is that right there. Well, that's going to be the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you kind of gained something from it. I'm not sure what it would be, but you know, I've just had a lot of guys that well, I wish I could do what you do, and I wish, if you want to do what I do, guys, just go out and do it. It may take you, it didn't happen to me in a couple of years, it's not going to happen to you in a couple of years, and the learning process of that is what's going to really make you an exceptional trapper. So, you know, bear through it, grit your teeth, find different ways to go about it, and just get it done. And most of all, enjoy the thrill of the chase. Enjoy the thrill of going out and finding that new sign and finding that little secret or that little extra detail in your trapping, or that new lure you've been looking for, or that new bait, or whatever it is. Keep growing, keep educating yourself, and you'll get it done. So till next week, have a good time trapping, guys.